We are blessed to have a special guest today. He spent 19 years playing Major League Baseball. He's been a big league manager even longer. And that's only part of his story. Welcome to In the Bullpen with Mark Dewey. You're listening to the Fight Laugh Feast Network. Thank you for joining us.
And look who's coming up. High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
His Major League playing career spanned from 1968 to 1986. Most of those with the Braves and the Dodgers, but he also played for the Giants and the A's. Two times he was named an All-Star. He was a Gold Glove winner, the MVP of the 1977 NLCS, and he was a member of the 1981 World Champion Los Angeles Dodgers. He has managed for 22 seasons. Three times he's been named Manager of the Year. He has managed the Giants, the Cubs, the Reds, and the Nationals, leading all of those teams to the postseason, most of them on more than one occasion. He is currently the manager for the Houston Astros. And as impressive as all of this may be, there's much more to the man than what he's done on the field and in the dugout. Dusty Baker is joining us today in the bullpen. Dusty, thanks for being with us.
All right. Excuse me. Hey, nice to be with you, Mark. We spent a lot of time together, and we've stayed in contact over the years, which is to both of our credits, you know, you as a player and now you're a coach, and me as one of your first coaches and managers.
Yes, and it has been great. As a matter of fact, it was last summer. We hadn't seen each other physically for a while, and last summer I was up with our AAA team in Sacramento, and you walked into the clubhouse, so that was nice.
Oh, yeah, it was nice to see you.
So during these kind of strange times, how are you and the family doing?
Well, we're doing fine. I mean, I've seen more people, walking down the street on walks or riding bikes together. It seems like, as bad as these times are, I feel that it's gotten a lot of families back to old time, values and culture. So, we're doing fine. My son's home from college. He's taken all his classes online. He's a junior. This was a big year for him. This is his draft year, so he's hoping that he gets drafted. I mean, he'll get drafted. It just depends on which round. But it's been nice. It's been nice to see him in the morning, and then he comes in before bed and says his prayers with me, every night, like he did when he was a kid, and we're hitting in the cage every day and working out together. Just not quite warm enough to go swimming yet, but that's next. So hopefully we'll be back to work before it gets that hot.
Yeah, and I would also assume that you're probably doing some fishing while you have this time.
Well, I've only fished one time.
And, okay,
I'm actually going fishing tomorrow because I like to take him with me. We went to Alaska last August, first time we've had opportunity to go fishing in a long time. And so, he has classes Monday through Thursday. He's off on Friday. So I told him, last week, hey, man, I got a friend that has a private pond at his house. I said, you want to go fishing? He goes, oh, heck yeah, Dad. So, we're going fishing again, tomorrow. And, like I said, I haven't done a whole bunch of fishing, but I've been working in the yard, working in the vineyard. Cleaning closets. every closet's almost clean. Get my survival gear out, and then I'm taking a lot of clothes and shoes and products, to the homeless downtown Sacramento, which has a special spot, in my heart, because my brother, had a nervous breakdown like 35 years ago, and he passed a year ago, March. And so, he was homeless for a while and in and out of a bunch of institutions. And here's a kid that had double masters. He was certified wills, trust, taxes. And so I remember my mom used to tell me, quit laughing. Back in the days, we used to call the homeless bums, and my mom would say, quit laughing at the, at the homeless, because, he could have been a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. And so, she's telling the truth. And so, like I said, it has a special spot, in my heart. You know, I probably wrestled with, you know, with the Lord in my mind and in my heart for, you know, a few years there as to why sometimes. And it seems like you never get the answers as to why. But, I mean, you know, everything has a point and purpose in life, which my son reminded me of, you know, a few weeks ago.
Yeah. You know, that's when in the introduction I was talking about there being so much more to you than what we know about from a standpoint of baseball playing and managing, and that's just one incident. And I know that there have been a number of things in your life that you've come through the other end of some very difficult times, and you have a lot to offer, not only to the people that, let's say, you manage, like I had the privilege of playing for you back in the 90s, but many other people. And it kind of leads me to one of the questions I have. Knowing how much you have gone through and come through and experienced, the question I have, and we were texting back and forth around the time that you were interviewing for the Astros job, is what motivated you to go into a situation that you knew was going to be very difficult? You didn't have to do that, obviously, but you wanted to do it. But instead of coming through the other end of a trial that you didn't have any idea was coming your way, here you actually walked through the front door of what you knew would be a very difficult situation. Why did you do that?
Well, it seems like I've been called in this situation many, many, many times. And, you know, it wasn't my calling. You know, I mean, you know, from the minute I came into baseball, I really didn't want to play baseball. But my family, my mom and dad had got divorced. I was oldest of five. You know, I saw a way to help my family. I really didn't want to coach. At the time I was getting divorced, I really didn't want to manage because I was a stockbroker in 87, and then the stock market crashed, and I was like, this is, you know, this isn't, you know, not really for me. And then my brother, you know, had a breakdown. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that happened in my life where, you know, I had cancer later on, then I had a stroke later on after that. And then, you know, I prayed on all my decisions from the very beginning, you know, on what I should do and, you know, kind of what the Lord would, you know, wants me to do. And a lot of times, you know, I disagreed with the, you know, with the answer that I got in prayer, just like when I took the coaching job, I didn't want to coach. And so I went up to the mountaintop. My dad told me to go to the mountaintop. Me and my brother had to break down and just ask the Lord for direction. Well, before I even was checking in a hotel, and the guy tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around. It was Bob Lurie with the Giants, and I was trying to make up my mind. You know, the Giants was a team that wanted me. So he says, Dusty, you need to come, you know, come join us. So I went to the room, and I called my dad. I said, Dad, do you think that's a sign? And he goes, Son, if that's not a sign, he said, you got the sign even before you even checked in to go pray or anything. He said, you just didn't, that's not the sign you were looking for. And so, you know, that's what's happened most of my life. So I've just learned to, you know, whatever you pray for, you know, it might not be the answer that you want, or it might not be the direction that you want. And I talked to my son, to get back to your initial question about why, I talked to my wife and my son and, you know, my mom that's in assisted living, and, you know, they all said, hey, you know, there's something, even though you're busy in business, you got a solar company, you got a wine company, there's something that's still missing in your life, and I know you. And so I prayed on it, and, you know, I had no idea that that job was going to come available, because I had interviewed with the Phillies earlier, and I thought they had a good chance to win. You know, I had some selfish thoughts initially about, you know, I needed 137 victories for 2000. I wanted to be the first African American and only manager to have 2000. You know, the quest for a championship, you know, was there. You know, everything pointed towards, you know, my decision. But then I didn't get that job, and so my son said, Dad, you know, maybe the Lord didn't want you to go there. And, you know, out of the mouth of babes, you know, all of a sudden he's repeating some of the things that I had, you know, that I had told him. I said, hey, man, who's the dad here anyway? and so he says, Dad, everything happens for a reason. Again, I have some of the same things I told him. And so then, you know, when I interviewed for the Houston job, I had no clue that you were going to get a quality team like that. You know, when the World Series ended, I mean, the whole world would have guessed you know, the last two teams that would have changed managers, you know, other through illness or death or whatever it is, you know, would have been the Astros. And so, you know, one thing led to another. I went there and I interviewed and I say, look, I'll come interview. Just, I don't want to just be a token interview or just, you know, waste our time coming back and forth. Either you want me or, you know, you don't. My track record speaks for itself. So, you know, that's, and, you know, I welcome the challenge. I mean, ever since then, people are like, hey, man, you're the perfect man for the job. And I was like, well, why wasn't I a perfect man for any job besides this trophy? You know, and so, you know, that's why. I mean, like I said, I prayed on it also. You know, it's like, hey, you know, tell me what to do, because I've learned in my life, you know, I haven't always done the right thing, but I knew what the right thing was, you know, and I'd done a whole bunch of things probably wrong, but also knew it was wrong while I was doing it. And I was raised in the church, which I really didn't like going every Sunday. But, you know, it says train a child in the way he should go when he's young, and, you know, he will return to how he was raised. I'm paraphrasing. And so, anyway, that's what I've done. I, you know, I've returned to, you know, how I was raised, and I've just sort of learned to accept, you know, the role that, you know, the Lord chose for me. Because one of my teammates the other day, he called me and he says, hey, man, he says, you know, you're, you know, one of the chosen. I said, well, I guess I am. I mean, I look back on all my life and all the different things. I could have been killed probably 6 or 7 times in fast cars or somewhere there, you know, hunting or jumped off a cliff into the river or something. And I was like, well, you know, like I do have a guardian angel, and I do have, you know, like a protector. And my favorite movie every Christmas is A Wonderful Life with James Stewart.
Yep, mine too.
Yeah, I mean, I got to watch that every Christmas because I definitely have a, you know, have a guardian angel.
Well, a couple of things you said there. One, I'm just going to address in passing, and I want to focus more on the second one. When you talked about praying, I don't know if you remember this, but I remember it vividly, even though it has been, what, almost 24 years now. I came into your office. It was in Cincinnati. We were playing in Cincinnati. And on one day, I talked to you and Brian Sabian and told you about my plans for the future. And the next day, when I came back to the ballpark, you called me into your office and you said, hey, have you prayed about this? And I said, yeah, I have. And you said, did God answer your prayers? I said, I think he did. And then you said, did God answer your prayers or did you answer your prayers? And like I said, it's almost 24 years later, and that still has stuck with me. But what I really want to focus on, you talk about Darren talking back to you and teaching you back what you taught him. And I know your father had a huge impact on your life. And I'm testing my memory here, probably more than yours. So I hope I'm going by a true memory, because I don't remember if it's something that a conversation that took place, you know, on a plane or a bus or whatever. But it seems to me that you told a story at one time. It was when you were younger. I don't know if you were playing Little League or not, but some kind of a youth baseball. And you handled yourself in a way that was not what it should have been. And I believe your father was the coach, and he taught you a lesson that day. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, I remember. I remember I was kind of hardhead. My nickname was Hardhead till I was about 12 or 13. But it might be the story about my dad cutting me from his Little League team.
I think that's it.
And my dad was he was Bobby Bonds' coach before me. Bobby was 4 years older than me. And then he was my coach. And then when I was 8 years old, he cut me I struck out, I think, and I slung my bat up against the backstop. I had a terrible temper. So he cut me. And then I had to play for his friend. And then at 9 years old, during tryouts, I missed a ball. I stomped on it on my glove, and he cut me again. I had a bad attitude. And then at 10 years old, my friend told me he was going to hit me in the head. The only time I ever been hit in the head in my whole life, in my whole career, he did hit me in the head, and I quit. And my dad says, hey, man, no son of mine is going to quit at nothing. He says, I got too much money invested in you, that $9.99 Sears and Roebuck Ted Williams glove. And he sent me back to the minors again. So, and he told me, he says, if you can take that bad attitude you got and that temperament and put it in a positive direction that you could be something one day. And, you know, I'm big now when I see young players or kids or whatever it is. I mean, I'm big now on attitude. And when I see those some of the bad attitude kids, I mean, a lot of time these kids are the most talented kids, but they just need some direction. And, you know, I hate to think about, you know, I probably wouldn't even be here right now, you know, if I, you know, didn't get that lesson, that direction from my dad.
Yeah, that's a great story. I want to move ahead a little bit. You've kind of already covered, I was going to ask you about your decision to play professional baseball coming out of high school, but you've kind of covered that. But I have a question. I think most people know that you were a Marine, United States Marine Corps Reserve. And if I got my numbers right, you had that position, if you will, from 1969 to 1975, which would mean basically the very first part of your major league career. So my first question is, why did you decide to do that? And then what did it entail, and how did it have any kind of an impact as far as at the same time playing major league baseball?
Well, that's a great question. It had impact not only in baseball, it had impact on my life. And I was in college. See, I signed out of high school, but you had to go to college or either, you know, get your girlfriend pregnant or whatever it is, or, you know, to not, you know, to get out of the draft because Vietnam was hopped in.
Sure.
And so everything was in a non-conforming fashion. I was up here. Sacramento, hanging out in San Francisco. My dad didn't like me going to Berkeley. and so I was in school. And so I was training with the track team. And I didn't come out until June. And spring training starts in February because you had to carry 15 units per semester. No incompletes, no F's, which I never would have gotten, but my mom wouldn't have gone for that. And so, you know, or else you were drafted in between semesters. If you had incomplete or an F. And so I came out after working out the track team. I came out at, in June. You know, I led the team in hitting. I got called to the big leagues that September out of A-ball. And so they said, hey, man, you know, you're on a fast track. He says, you know, we want you to go to the reserves. Or if not, then you have to go to school all year again and come out in June. And so I had a choice between the National Guard and the Marines. And so I was like, no, I'm not joining the National Guard because National Guard then was being called out, you know, on the riots, the many riots that we were having in our country at that time. There was unrest everywhere. And so I joined the Marines. I joined the Marine Reserves. Like I said, I really didn't want to, but once I got there, as competitive as I am, they said one guy was going to be in dress blue, and they made me the platoon, not the platoon leader, the guide on that's in charge of all the platoons, and they made me in charge of everybody, and I didn't want to be in charge. You know, they always put me in charge. I just wanted to be a regular Marine and get out. But I learned some valuable lessons. I learned about teamwork, big-time teamwork, because, you know, if you have to guard a guy's life that you may not like, you may have differences of opinion, differences of religion, differences of race, differences of different parts of the country. But that is teamwork. That's really learning to coexist in the workplace, much like you have to do in any other job, whether it's baseball, whether it's in an office or whatever. But that is a teamwork to its finest when you have to guard a guy's life. And so I would have to leave once I got back to ball. I'd have to leave every month for you know, a week and a month we'd have to do, and then I'd leave 2 weeks every summer, you know, wherever unit I was in, because I would transfer units from Shreveport. That was a MP unit. Then I'd go to Richmond, AAA. That was a 50 caliber Howard, you know, howitzer unit. And when I was the one summer camp, I had brig duty at Pendleton. You know, I was at, like you see, with a tower and a light. And, boy, I mean, imagine, you know, at that time, you know, I was a bit confused because, you know, everybody had an afro. It showed your you know, political beliefs, and you know, how long can your hair grow in a month? Because you had to go every month. And so, you know, like I said, years later, you know, I met some heck of a dudes in the Marines, and it taught me some, you know, some valuable lessons. It taught me lessons in baseball, as far as training, as far as discipline, you know, lessons that I really thought that I knew. And my dad was in the Navy during World War II, and so, you know, we were raised kind of military wise, and not knowing that, you know, we were raised like that. This just, you know, how I thought life was. But like I said, I had some valuable lessons. I met some heck of a dudes. I met some country dudes from Mississippi that my partners. I met some other, some Puerto Rican dudes from New York, some brothers from Detroit, Baltimore. And so it just really taught me how to get along, you know, with everybody, no matter where you're from or no matter what race you're, you know, you are.
Yes, and that has been obvious in the way, especially as a manager, in the way you've been able to get along with and handle people and deal with people from various backgrounds. Now, as a player, during your days playing, who had the greatest impact on you? Who, along with the United States Marine Corps, but now I'm talking about somebody you played maybe with or against, who had the greatest impact on your life as well as your baseball career?
Well, without a doubt, Hank Aaron. And Hank Aaron was my dad, you know, away from home. He promised my mom, when I was 18, I signed in Dodger Stadium with the Braves. He promised my mom that he would take care of me as if I was his son. And he promised her that he would make me go to church, make me get up and eat breakfast, make me not hang out all night at the clubs, all the stuff that the young boys wanted to do. You know, the fun stuff. I'm 18 now.
Oh, yeah.
I can do what I want. But I always had him, and then my roommate, Ralph Garr. Ralph Garr was from the South. And, you know, all our teams on the Braves are from the South, and I was from California, even though my dad's from the South. But, you know, it was a totally different outlook on things. You couldn't go where you wanted to go. You couldn't necessarily talk to who you want to talk to. You couldn't eat in restaurants. And so Ralph really, really, you know, helped me out a lot. I was 18 out of California, and he was 21 or 22, going on 22, out of Grambling, Louisiana. He went to Grambling College. And so, you know, we were as different as night and day. But you know, I like to think we helped each other. You know, I had a theory. I was 18, and he was 22 from Louisiana, and I was from California. So that made us the same age. The only thing is he didn't buy that theory that I was trying to sell to him. you know, another, you know, very influential person was Mr. Bill Lucas, who was the first black farm director in baseball. And Hank was married to Mr. Lucas's sister. I was Hank's first wife. And also then when I got to the Dodgers, I was so lucky. I had, like, you know, I had, you know, Jim Gilliam when I first got there. And then the guys that would come see me and talk to me, you know, like I remember Carl Erskine and Sandy Koufax. And, you know, not name dropping, but these guys had major influences over me. You know, Roy Campanella came in his wheelchair, and, you know, he'd be at spring training. And I think I mentioned Jim Gilliam, you know, already. I mean, he was very, very, you know, influential over me. And, you know, the Dodgers always had, you know, a lot of their veterans, you know, come around. You know, Tommy Davis, I mean, that's why I wore number 12. I was trying to be like Tommy Davis as a kid. So,
okay.
You know, how many kids end up wearing their hero's uniform number, playing the position, batting in the order where he batted, and also, you know, became good friends with him, and he's a better person than he was a player. Because I've been disappointed sometimes, which I had never met a couple of my heroes. You know, I always say it just remained as a hero, and I never knew him as a player. But, you know, those are just some of the people that are – and, you know, Joe Black used to – you know, I was struggling one time, and he told me, he said, Dusty, you're a hitter, not a slugger. And so, you know, just something that these guys can tell you sometimes that will you know, just, you know, put everything in sync and everything back into motion.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, a couple of podcasts ago, I was talking about generations staying connected, and I was referring back to when I first got to the big leagues with the Giants. You were the hitting coach at the time, and, you know, Rick Rushel and Don Robinson and Terry Kennedy and Gary Carter, veteran guys, have been around a while, and them understanding that they had a certain responsibility to the young guys like myself and Eric Gunderson and Leo, those guys. And my question is, you know, you go obviously further back than me as far as your playing days. Your major league career started 20 plus years before mine. I always thought that's the way it was. My question is, do you think it's still the way it is? Do you think there's still that idea of the older players, the older generation, kind of taking a person under the wing? In other words, I mean, I know Hank Aaron is an outlier, not only in his talent, but in who he is as a person. But do you think today that there would be a Hank Aaron type person that would say to somebody's mother, hey, I'm taking care of your son?
Yeah, well, possibly, yeah. I mean, I think there's some guys, but I think a lot of it depends on the younger guy, you know, having open ears, you know, to listen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's as important as me telling you, is that you listening or you coming, you know, to me for advice. Now, I'm not going to say I always listen to Hank, you know, but Hank used to tell me, hey, look, you may not hear what I say, but just retain what I'm telling you. And that was important. And there are sometimes 4 or 5 years later, some of the stuff he would tell me, you know, would come back, you know, would resonate to me, much like my son resonated to me earlier in the interview I was telling you about.
Sure.
You know, and so I think retention is the most important part. Now, the disciplinary ways that people do things now are different than it was then. You know, I mean, there were a couple of times Hank Aaron grabbed me by my neck. You know what I mean? And I'm like, he's like, I said, man, you better let me go. He says, then what? And I'm like, well, I'll think of something. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, the ways that you employ discipline, but I was, you know, I could be a little wise butt at the time too. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm looking back, you know, because I always had kind of an answer for, you know, that last, used to get me in trouble as a kid.
Sure.
So that, you know, that speaking under your breath, or, you know, my dad would tell me, you better get your eyes off the ceiling, boy. You know what I mean? It was like, there ain't nothing up in that ceiling. Now when I see kids do that, I'm like, oh, no, now I know why my dad, my dad would get so upset. But, you know, guys tend to, not be as close, to each other. But the good teams are very close. And when I hear people say there's no such thing as chemistry in sports and ball, I mean, you've been on good and bad chemistry teams.
Sure.
And there is a big, big difference. And that'll eat away of whatever talent that you have, a bad chemistry team, and it'll create more talent as a unit on a good chemistry team. So, yeah, I mean, I still see guys, doing things, and taking care of some of the young guys, but it takes more of a special kind of, guy. You know, when we first came up, we had to carry all the veterans' bags, to their rooms and stuff. They didn't, pay the bellman, but in turn, they would all, they wouldn't let us pay for anything, for meals. They bought us our first suit. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Just small things that will, last for a lifetime in order to pass it by. And I remember the guys that treated me when I came up. I mean, imagine me. I'm in the big leagues at 19 years old, and, I'm hanging with the guys that I just saw on TV. Orlando Cepeda, I mean, to this day, he's like my uncle. The late Cleve Boyer, he was like my uncle. I mean, I had some guys, that really, really you know, took care of us. Felix Mian and different guys. Cito Gaston. Cito, I got to call Cito when I get off the phone here. I mean, Cito, I was in Double A. I was playing my first game in 67. And a ball was hit to me in right field. He was playing center. Rob was in left. And I dropped the ball. And they had let some people out of the mental institution next door to the ballpark in Little Rock. Well, I didn't know that they were from the mental institution. They let them out every Thursday to come watch the ball game, and they sat over by me, and they were calling me all these names, man. And I was like, man, I want to go home. And Cito Gaston told me, hey, man, I'll take care of you. You know, I always had an older guy, you know, take care of me. You know, I had Joe Pepitone in Atlanta for a while. And so, you know, moral to my story is, I mean, we're still tight, you know. I mean, after, it's been 50-something years since I played that, you know, that first game. But here I am still friends with, you know, with Cito. And so this is what baseball does. You know, it creates friendships, lasting friendships. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we all go, you know, ups and downs through, you know, each other, you know, tears and laughter, you know, that create lasting, you know, relationships.
Nick, I could be on the phone with you forever, but out of respect for your time, I have two more questions. One may be harder than the other. First question, you've been in the game professionally for over 50 years, so you have played with and against, or you've managed or managed against, in my opinion, some of the greatest players in the history of baseball. So my question is, of all the people that you've seen with your own eyes, who would you say, and you can do it in order if you want, or you can just do it randomly, who would you say are the best or top three players that you've ever seen?
Boy, that is tough. Probably Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, and Barry Bonds.
I had no idea. I figured you'd have Hank Aaron in there for sure. I had no idea how you would answer that. And even though I obviously didn't see with my eyes Hank and Willie, those would be my top three players as well as far as during my lifetime. That's very interesting.
You know, you're talking Frank Robinson, Al Kaline.
Right, right.
Past. I mean, I love Al Kaline. You know, Roberto Clemente, you could tell I was partial to, you know, the outfielders. So that's what I was. You know what I mean? And so, but, you know, I grew up, like I said, if I had pitchers, that'd be Bob Gibson and, you know, Sandy Koufax, Juan Marichal. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some, I saw some great, great players. I mean, Pete Rose, he ain't far behind those guys that I named earlier.
Okay.
You know, and so, you know, list goes on and on and on because, you know, they never stopped making great ball players. You know, George Brett, Mike Schmidt. I mean, he that's why they break it down by the top 50 per position or top 20, you know, per position, because it's hard to say, you know, who's the greatest.
Yeah. And the last thing, you mentioned it a couple of times. You have a winery, and I don't know how long you've had it. I know that not last year, but in 2018, for Thanksgiving through Advent and Christmas, our family bought one bottle of each of your wines and had them through the holiday season. When did that get started, and what is that all about?
Well, actually, you know, I had 2 acres at my house that I didn't know what to do with, because here I got like 5 acres, and I didn't want to landscape the whole thing, and I was going to build a pond, except it was on a slight slope. And I said, and I was going to build a pond, catch fish, come in and eat them, but my insurance man said it was good rain. I'd flood my neighbors, and I'd have a problem, a liability problem, insurance problem. So I said, well, I was with Mondavi on the advisory staff when I was with the Giants and the Cubs, and I'd go to dinner and lunches, you know, representing them at Canandaigua and the Southern Wine and Spirits and just, you know, different people they were selling their wines to. And so Michael Mondavi and I went to Montana a couple times fly fishing, and I said, hey, you know anybody that can help me, you know, choose my rootstock to, you know, do my stakes, do my wires? He goes, yeah, I got the perfect guy for you. Well, you know, we planted 14 years ago, and then a couple years later, They were like 3 years old. We were giving it away to my buddies. They said, it's pretty good. And so, you know, I wanted to grow Cabernet grapes, and he says I was in the wrong climate, wrong region for it, and I was in the region for Syrah. And so one thing led to another. Then we ended up going to became legal at the Treasure Island. San Francisco was killing us to drive down there all the time, like 2 hours, and come back. And so we moved to West Sacramento. And so we started out with about 50 to 60 cases. That's what I grew on my property, which I was out there this morning pinching the grapes. Well, they're not there yet, but I was pinching the vines. And so, and then we started buying juice from all kind of farmers around, because my buddy was and partner. He was the head of viticulture department at UC Davis. And so consequently, he knows all the farmers from Napa, Sonoma, Mendocino, Shenandoah Valley, you know, different regions. And so we get the best juice, and most time the first pick. So now we got seven varietals. We started out with Syrah. Now we got seven different, varietals. So it's fulfilling. It's great. I'm a farmer at heart. So was my dad. And, I just like to see stuff growing. I'm pretty good at growing stuff.
Excellent. So if somebody wanted to know more about it, or maybe even place an order, where would they go?
They'd go to Baker Family Wines. You can look it up, bakerfamilywines.com. And our email is bnbwinecompany@gmail.com. So, and, you know, not bragging, but, you know, people tell me it's pretty good. And our thing is, from the beginning, I told a winemaker, I said, hey, look, I'm not going to have no rot gut with my name on it. So, and so he said, I tell you what, your name might sell the first bottle of wine, but the quality is going to sell, wine, you know, after that. And so that's our pact, and, quality, you know, before quantity.
We did order it, and we did enjoy it. Both my wife and I, our favorite was the Dusty Syrah. So,
oh, yeah.
We can speak
but
to
that one. That one runs out pretty quick, because we only get like 60 cases off my property. That's my favorite too, actually. And I got a proprietary red that's a real good one. I got a proprietary white, and we have a, which is mostly Semillon grapes, and we have a, you know, Sauvignon Blanc. We have two Zinfandels from different regions, and we also have another Syrah that goes along with Dusty's. And hopefully at the end of the summer, you know, Hank Aaron is part of our company. Now I'm telling you some hot off the press stuff. Him and Thomas Moorhead, one of his best friends. And so now we're going to have a Hank Aaron 755 Bull Cabernet, which is what he wanted.
So, very nice.
Oh, yeah, so this is in honor of him.
Excellent. Well, Dusty, it has been, as always, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, man. And good luck, dude.
Thank you.
All right. See you later.
See ya. I hope you were all as blessed as I was, and I have so many more questions to ask of Dusty. But that's a conversation for another day. Join us again next time on In the Bullpen on the Fight Laugh Feast Network. Thank you for listening.